When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to Wednesday Wonders on the Mutual Audio Network. Be amazed.
The following audio drama is rated G for general audiences.
Oh, a story. All right. I was working the coastal boats along the free states, and you have to understand one thing about these city states, or none of this will make any sense to you, and that is each of the city states absolutely hates their next door neighbor. The next one down the way is all right, no real problem with them, but it's their rival neighbors they hate. So they go out of their way to be entirely different from them. Over the course of the centuries, this continued animosity means that they will not even speak the same language, much less style their hair or cook the same way. This makes for peculiar circumstances for traders, because one city, for example, will wear silk capes at court, which of course means at the very least the two cities on either side will execute anyone showing up to court wearing silk. It's that serious. So each city-state, run by a baron, will have its own dialect or language completely different from its neighbors. They will have their own court etiquette, their own preferred foods, everything will be different from their immediate neighbors. And if word gets to them that something is suddenly in style at one of their neighbors, it is immediately punishable by death to be styling in that particular way in the other city. So, I was with a certain coastal trader. We would go up and down the coast, buying and selling and profiting, but we had to be careful not to sell something that was in fashion at the immediate neighbor's city. Some would take chances and sell an item, knowing full well that it was out of favor, but they would shrug and say buyer beware if the buyer did not keep up with what was currently outlawed. Again, I can't describe in too minute detail with what fanaticism they hold their contempt for their neighbors. They will not build their buildings in the same fashion, they adopt an entirely new design, or borrow something from the elves or the dwarves in order to ensure that they are different. And the inner architecture would be different, where one city would have a receiving room directly before the main court, another would have reception to the side, and you would enter the main room from a determined side. All of this because it is in their nature to hate how their neighbor lived. Now, you'd think that this overt hatred would lead to war and an attempt to destroy each other, but instead they don't want to dirty their hands with the blood of their neighbors. They would be forever unclean and unable to function in their own city if they were sullied with something as personal as the blood of their neighboring city. So, bloody warfare is unthinkable to them. They hate their neighbors so, and so they spend their time attempting to become more prosperous than their neighbor. It's a never-ending animosity, and everyone does what they can to raise the standards of the city to be more prosperous than their hated neighbors. That is how they conduct warfare. Now, fortunately for traders, in between these giant competing city-states are little coastal towns that don't care about hating their neighbor or appearing more prosperous, and they will buy or sell anything they please. So, usually, what happens is that after trading directly with one city-state, everything that didn't sell to them, you try to unload on the coastal towns. Or better yet, trade for what is style-approved in the next city-state. As it so happens, we left the coast of Planarius and were heading toward Gallus when a big gale hit us. At first, we tried to get into a safe harbor, and then, when we couldn't, we tried to go out into the open sea to avoid getting crushed upon the rocks. As fate turned out, our little coaster got impaled on a sharp rock submerged beneath the waves, and we began to take on some serious water into our cog. Our ship eventually broke up, and it was on a large piece of wood I held on for flotation to finally bring me into the shore. I don't know what happened to the rest of the ship's crew. I washed ashore with the flotsam and jetsam of our wreck, and it was there that I was found by the city guard of Gallus. Miraculously, I was brought before the Baron, and there, while I was still trying to knock the seawater out of my ears, I found myself convicted of heresy and treason. Before I could come to my senses, I asked, "Doesn't one have to be a citizen of a realm before they could be found guilty of treason?" Ow! The cuff to my head that I received told me that I wasn't going to lawyer myself out of the predicament. I finally asked what it was that made these good people think I was an antagonist to their city, when a ragged piece of cloth was brought forward. I recognized it as a fine piece of fabric I had purchased from Flanarius and had planned to resell it in the next city over of Roten. But here, in Gallus, it was as if I had wrapped myself in a Flanarian flag and declared my allegiance to that state. "I know not the origins of this cloth, my lords," was my first denial. There were many more denials to come. "'Struth, I don't trade in the great cities along this coast," I said, which was untrue, except for in that moment where I believed it with every fiber of my heart as being all honesty. "But instead, I am content to dabble amongst the coastal towns in between the city-states. There are no taxes and tariffs to avoid," which was also true, though not something I would normally admit to. But I figured it would be best to admit to what would be a small transgression in their eyes and appear to be slightly guilty of a small thing like avoiding taxes, than to be thought that all I claimed was untrue, including the treasonous act of having commerce with their hated enemy. The Inquisition went on like this for what seemed like an eternity, the magistrate there thinking every fourth question to ask if I had commerce with Flanarius, as if I would mistakenly sometime get tripped up and say, "Oh, my word, yes, here's my trading permit, signed and dated last week." Which, by good fortune, the trading permit that I had acquired to buy and sell in that city was at the bottom of the ocean, with my cash box. That my cash box was at the bottom as well was a mixed blessing, as it meant I was immediately poor and could not offer any kind of cash compensation for my misdemeanors that I was currently admitting to, or to offer a bribe to an official who might lose my case among his busy schedule. On the fortunate side, my cash box on the ocean floor also meant that the coins contained therein, freshly minted with the flag and crest of Flanarius, would further damn me and make accusation against the lies I was now heaping upon the court that I have no dealings whatsoever with their rival neighbor. My other strategy, while I was facing this public inquisition, was to endear myself to the ones who would be deciding my fate, especially the Baron, who was witnessing this interrogation, but whom had, up to and including this moment, not yet spoken. And so I peppered my responses with reverence to the court that was trying to convict me, disdain every time Flanarius was mentioned, which, as I said, was quite often, as well as a jesting remark to keep some levity in the situation that would also try and make the situation not seem to be as grave as my inquisitors were making it. Finally, the magistrate grilling me gave up trying to catch me into admitting my allegiance to Flanarius, and announced to the room and to the Baron of the city-state that he had completed his questioning, and that a verdict was in order. The Baron stirred and adjusted himself in his seat as if he had just woken up. There is the possibility that was the case. Or that he had made up his mind long ago, but let his counsel continue in his questions until he felt satisfied. Now this is where I was all attention, for the Baron was clearly the one passing judgment, and I had quite the personal investment in what that judgment would be. And to that end, the first words to come out of his mouth were of vital importance, as up to this point I had very little to go on as to how I could sway his judgment to my favor. I had not much to go on of the Baron, the man, his likes and dislikes, and how I could be liked, his concerns and cares, and how I could make sure I was not against any of them. "You seem to enjoy making light of this proceedings, defendant," he began. Now I had something I could work with. "Well, these are not grave matters, my lord," I replied. "I know for myself that I am not the ugly person the magistrate is attempting to reveal here, and in knowing this, it is but a lark, and I figured I would make my lord's time grow easier during these long proceedings." He adjusted his seat once more, and I knew that he was indeed bored with this entire finding, but he didn't want his officials to think he was disengaged with his authority. I knew he would deal with me swiftly. Therefore, I decree, he drawled, since you approach the evidence against you with cheer and jokes, that your life or death shall hang upon it as well. Make me laugh. Excuse me, my lord? I was stunned in that moment, and if you can believe it of me, speechless. You say your levity is based upon how innocent you are in this matter. Make me laugh, and you shall prove your innocence. If you fail, that proves you are guilty. Tell me a joke to save your life. Now, many things rushed through my mind all at once, and I shall not belabor telling you all of them, but here's three. First came a rush of all my standby jests and jibes, which never miss in a tavern full of inebriated locals, but no one in this room was inebriated, and if I had to bet my life on it, the Baron was slightly hungover already. Secondly, with all the jokes that I had at the ready, they might involve something which was verboten in this city. I could tell a joke about the lusty priest, which is usually a winner, but what if in this city they deeply revere their religious authorities? I could tell a joke involving bumbling landlords, or cuckold husbands, or simpleton farmers, but this was a new crowd with new likes and dislikes, all of them, it seemed, to be very decided about, and I had not had any previous experience in the city proper to get a local line on things. In that regard, it seemed like a flip of the coin that they would either like or dislike a subject, and that's a bad place to start when your audience is a room full of people who just a moment ago were trying to establish that I was in alliance with the people they hate. And lastly, and perhaps the most unfairly, someone who had just shown no mirth during the hour I had been there, and that I suspected was slightly hungover, had just demanded that I make them laugh. Of all the audiences that are hardest to surprise, to delight with the unexpected, is someone who was thoroughly expecting something to surprise them. My heart sunk in the moment. As it is commonly known, the toughest audience in the world is someone who says, "Make me laugh." And there I was. My life depended upon it. And I didn't know what their predisposition was on ministers, farmers, or cuckolds. It was all a toss-up. But I did know one solid thing, however, I could use. It was the reason for me being there in the first place. It was the prejudice that they were holding above me and prepared to condemn me for. It was a dead certainty, though I shouldn't use the word dead in these circumstances, it would be unlucky. I had a shot. I had one shot. And I took it. I had a royal decree from the Baron of the city-state of Gallus to make him laugh, and I took in a big breath and fully committed to my words, as sincere as I could possibly make them. My lord, why don't Flanarians live here in Gallus? You could hear a pin drop, as there was a great single intake of breath in the entire room. The Baron shifted again, and then replied in a growl through clenched teeth, I don't know why. Because they're stupid. Immediately, the Baron burst out into laughter like the roar of a dragon. The room literally thundered with massive laughing from all the officials and onlookers in the room. Desks were pounded, walls were kicked, floors were stomped in delight of the punchline. The payoff was enormous, and what began as a solemn, serious proceeding to decide whether or not to hang me, or cut my head off, or toss me bound in the ocean, whatever was the means of capital punishment, it had turned into the best joke of the day. Needless to say, I was found innocent of the charges. This joke became so famous and tickled the fancy of the Baron so that he kept me on in his own private staff to cheer him up whenever he needed it. I was to, at my best discretion, inject levity into his day and keep him cheery. I was, in essence, his jester. And it was inevitable that each day he would have me repeat the same joke. Why don't Flanarians live in Gallus? Because they're stupid! And it never got old to him. It was always a knee slapper. He would recall this joke when he would be in meetings for taxation or commerce, and he would turn to me and say, hey, why don't Flanarians have a tax on fishing imports? And I would reply, because they're stupid, my lord. He would guffaw at the clever joke he just made. Dignitaries from other cities would come, and he would prompt me to tell the joke, and I would repeat it word for word, inflection for inflection of the original, and the Baron would howl with mirth and glee. Most dignitaries would not see why this was so funny, I could tell by their puzzled faces, but they would smile and laugh along with the Baron to be diplomatic, or because they could see he enjoyed the joke so much. Now, on the technical side of things, I had told no joke, I just made a statement calling the rival people stupid, and the people of Gallus thought it to be the funniest thing ever told. At times, I even tried to change up the joke just a little so that maybe the nuance would keep it fresh and funny, but it was never tolerated, and the Baron would say, "No, no, that's not how it goes. It goes, why don't Flanarians live in Gallus? Because they're stupid." Riotous laughter would ensue. So, I became his jester. On probation, actually. I realistically felt that if I didn't keep him amused during the day, the order would come down to execute me. So I didn't mind that I had the old standby of the joke to literally keep me alive. Every once in a while, he would call upon me not to make jokes, but he would ask, "What would an outsider think of this?" or "How do your people approach this problem?" I never told him that I really don't have a people, but to him, I was the voice of the other people, the ones they didn't immediately despise. This gradually meant that I became an unofficial advisor to the Privy Council, and then, after my advice would prove to be worthy, I did then become an official advisor. Eventually, I did so well that he put me in charge of his own personal household, managing the mundane things and keeping the house well-run and to not be a bother. I had a discretionary budget to use as I saw fit to improve or repair his holdings, run the family household and the children, as well as host outrageous parties so that the soirees at Gallus would be talked about over in the neighboring Flanarius or Rotun. It was a job of dreams, actually, with many advantages and privileges, and something that would have suited me for the rest of my life. However, as it happens, when one's fortune is tied into the fortunes of another, the Baron fell out of favor and became disgraced in the eyes of the city's people, and his lordship was removed and replaced with one for which there were better expectations. And then I was forced to abandon the household and keep as far a distance as I could from his influence, lest I would receive disfavor merely by being associated with him. His light in the heavens fell like a shooting star, and I would not fall with him. And that, my gentles, is why you shall never find me along the coast of the Free States ever again.
You've been listening to Seneschal's Story, written and directed by David Ian. Voice talent for the character Seneschal by Daniel Rovan. Sound engineering by Dino D'Elfwild. Sound design by David Ian. Theme by Ron Perovich. Music by Mark Rose. Seneschal's Story is a fireside adventure short story of the Dungeons & Damsels series produced by Unchained Productions.